Hello, this is Mark Greyer. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 8th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, first article for today. Trump says U.S. oversight of Venezuela could last for years. In a wide-ranging interview with the New York Times on Wednesday, President Trump said only time will tell when it comes to how long the United States aims to control the country. President Trump said on Wednesday evening that he expected the United States would be running Venezuela and extracting oil from its huge reserves for years, and insisted that the interim government of the country, all former loyalists to the now imprisoned Nicolas Maduro, is giving us everything that we feel is necessary. Only time will tell, he said, when asked how long the administration will demand direct oversight of the South American nation. With hovering threat of American military action from an armada just off the shore. We will rebuild it in a very profitable way, Mr. Trump said during a nearly two-hour interview. We're going to be using oil, and we're going to be taking oil. We're getting oil prices down, and we're going to be giving money to Venezuela, which they desperately need. Mr. Trump's remarks came hours after administration officials said the United States plans to effectively assume control of selling Venezuela's oil indefinitely, part of the three-phase plan that Secretary of State Marco Rubio outlined for members of Congress, while Republican lawmakers have been largely supportive of the administration's actions. Democrats on Wednesday reiterated their warnings that the United States was headed toward a protracted international intervention without clear legal authority. During the wide-ranging interview with the New York Times, Mr. Trump did not give a precise time range for how long the United States would remain Venezuela's political overlord. Would it be 3 months, 6 months, a year, longer? I would say much longer, the president replied. Over the course of the interview, Mr. Trump addressed a wide range of topics, including the fatal ICE shooting in Minnesota, immigration, the Russian-Ukrainian war, Greenland, and NATO, his health and his plans for further White House renovations. Mr. Trump did not answer questions about why he recognized Mr. Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, as Venezuela's new leader instead of backing Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader whose party led a successful election campaign against Mr. Maduro in 2024 and recently won the Nobel Peace Prize. He declined to comment when asked if he had spoken to Ms. Rodriguez. But Marco speaks to her all the time, he said of the Secretary of State. Mr. Trump added, I will tell you that we are in constant communication with her and the administration. Mr. Trump also made no commitments about when elections would be held in Venezuela, which had a long democratic tradition from the late 1950s until Hugo Chavez took power in 1999. Shortly after 4, New York Times reporters sat down to speak with him. Mr. Trump paused the interview to take a call from President Gustavo Petro of Colombia. Days after Mr. Trump threatened to target the country because of its role as a cocaine hub. As the call was connected, the president invited the Times reporters to remain in the Oval Office to hear the conversation with the Colombian president, on the condition that its contents remain off the record. He was joined in the room by Vice President J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio, both of whom left after the call concluded. After speaking to Mr. Petro, Mr. Trump dictated to an aide a post for his social media account saying that the Colombian president had called to explain the situation of drugs coming out of rural cocaine mills in Colombia, and that Mr. Trump had invited him to visit Washington. Mr. Petro's call, which ran about an hour, appeared to dissipate any immediate threat of U.S. military action. And Mr. Trump indicated he believed that the decapitation of the Maduro regime had intimidated other leaders in the region to fall into line. During the lengthy conversation with the Times, Mr. Trump revealed in the success of the operation that broke into the heavily fortified compound in Caracas and then resulted in the capture of Mr. Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores. He said he had tracked the training of the forces for the operation down to the creation of a life-sized replica of the compound at a military facility in Kentucky. The president said that as the operation unfolded, he was worried it could end up being a Jimmy Carter disaster that destroyed his entire administration. He was referring to the failed operation on April 28, 1980, to rescue 52 American hostages held in Iran. An American helicopter collided with an aircraft in the desert, a tragedy that haunted Mr. Carter's legacy, but led to the creation of a far more disciplined, well-trained special operations forces. I don't know that he would have won the election, Mr. Trump said of Mr. Carter, but he certainly had no chance after that disaster. He contrasted the success of the seizure of Mr. Maduro in an operation that appears to have killed about 70 Venezuelans and Cubans, among others, to operations under his predecessors that had gone wrong. You know, you didn't have a Jimmy Carter crashing helicopters all over the place, and you didn't have a Biden-Afghanistan disaster where they couldn't do the simplest maneuver, he said, referring to the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan that resulted in the deaths of 13 American service members. Mr. Trump said that he had already begun to make money for the United States by taking oil that has been under sanctions. He referred to his Tuesday night announcement that the United States would obtain 30 to 50 million barrels of heavy Venezuelan crude oil. But he offered no time period for that process, and he acknowledged it would take years to receive the country's neglected oil sector. The oil will take a while, he said. Mr. Trump appeared far more focused on the capture mission than the details of how to navigate Venezuela's future. He declined to say what might prompt him to put American forces on the ground in the country. I wouldn't want to tell you that, he said. Would he insert American troops if the Venezuelan government blocked him from access to the country's oil? Would he send them in if Venezuela refused to kick out Russian and Chinese personnel, and as his administration has demanded? I can't tell you that, Mr. Trump said. I really wouldn't want to tell you that, but they're treating us with great respect. As you know, we're getting along very well with the administration that is there right now. He sidestepped the question about why he declined to install the man the United States declared the winner of the 2024 Venezuelan presidential election, Edmundo Gonzalez. Mr. Gonzalez was essentially a proxy candidate for the lead opposition leader, Ms. Machado. He reiterated that Mr. Maduro's allies are cooperating with the United States, despite their hostile public statements. They're giving us everything that we feel is necessary, he said. Don't forget, they took the oil from us years ago. He was referring to the nationalization of facilities built by American oil companies. Mr. Trump has already been talking to American oil executives about investing in the Venezuelan fields. But many are reluctant, worried that the operation to run the country could falter when Mr. Trump leaves office, or that the Venezuela's military and intelligence services would undercut the effort because they were being cut out of the profits. Mr. Trump said that he would like to travel to Venezuela in the future. "I think at some point it'll be safe," he said. Okay, next article. We pressed Trump on his conclusion about the ICE shooting. Here's what he said. The exchange was a glimpse into the president's reflexive defense of his federal crackdown on immigration. President Trump wanted to run the tape. Just hours after an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent shot a 37-year-old woman in Minneapolis on Wednesday, Mr. Trump told a group of the New York Times reporters that the woman was at fault because she tried to run over the officer. "We were in the Oval Office for an interview with the president, and the unfolding situation in Minnesota was high on our list of questions. As soon as we started asking him about the incident, he said, 'I want to see nobody get shot. I want to see nobody screaming and trying to run over policemen either.' When we pressed Mr. Trump on his conclusion that the victim, Renee Nicole Good, tried to run over the agent, he asked an aide to pull up the video on a laptop in an effort to prove his point. That was a vicious situation that took place," Mr. Trump said, apparently referring to what federal officials have said was an effort by Ms. Good to run down an ICE agent. The exchange was a glimpse into Mr. Trump's reflexive defense of what has become a sometimes violent federal crackdown on immigration, which in this case claimed the life of an American citizen who was protesting ICE's presence in Minneapolis. Speaking at a news conference in Minneapolis, Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, said that the woman was stalking officers and that the agent who killed her used his training to save his own life and that of his colleagues. But details were in dispute. State and local officials described federal accounts of the shooting with a term like propaganda and garbage. Mr. Trump stuck to his position, even as we pointed out the inconsistencies with the lack of clarity in videos circulating in social media. We asked if, in his mind, firing into a vehicle like that is acceptable. "She behaved horribly," Mr. Trump said, "and then she ran him over. She tried to run him over. She ran him over." We told the president the videos on social media were unclear. "I'll play the tape for you right now," Mr. Trump said. Mr. Trump's aide, Natalie Harp, brought a laptop over to the Resolute desk to show us what he said would be evidence of the woman's wrongdoing. Before the video began, Mr. Trump acknowledged the tragic nature of the shooting. "With all of it being said, no, I don't like that happening," he said, before pivoting to his common refrain of criticizing illegal immigration. As a slow-motion surveillance video of the shooting played on the laptop, we told him that this angle did not appear to show an ICE officer had been run over. "Well," Mr. Trump said, the way I look at it, it's a terrible scene," Mr. Trump said at the end of the video. "I think it's horrible to watch. No, I hate to see it." But did this fatal shooting mean his ICE operations had gone too far? Mr. Trump sidestepped the question, instead blaming his predecessor's immigration policies. Mr. Trump's willingness to make a near immediate conclusion about the deadly shooting appeared to be at odds with one of his senior advisors, Tom Homan, Mr. Trump's border czar, told CBS News that he would not make a judgment call on video circulating on social media of the shooting. "Let the investigation play out," Mr. Homan said, "and hold people accountable based on the investigation." Okay, next up in a related article. Fatal shooting by ICE follows weeks of turmoil in Minnesota. Residents of the state said they were reeling after a series of blows that have exposed a deepening rift between the Trump administration and Minnesota leaders. The blows in Minnesota began landing last year when a fraud scandal in the state's social services system ripped through the national news and disgusted taxpayers. Then in December, Mr. Trump laced into Somalia refugees, a group that has settled in Minnesota in large numbers, saying they were garbage that he did not want in this country. Just after Christmas, another jolt. A conservative influencer posted a video that went viral online claiming that daycare centers in Minneapolis were cheating taxpayers out of more than $100 million. And this week, as federal officials threatened to cut funding for Minnesota's social services programs and a new surge of federal immigration agents arrive in Minnesota, the state's beleaguered governor, Tim Walz, said that he would not run for re-election. But it was the shooting death of a 37-year-old woman by a federal immigration officer along a Minneapolis street on Wednesday that exposed just how wide a gulf there is between the Trump administration and Minnesota's Democratic leaders. At a news conference, Mr. Walz delivered an angry message to President Trump. "You've done enough." Hours later, Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, labeled the woman who was killed a terrorist and vowed to continue aggressive enforcement actions in the city. The clash left residents expressing anguish and fear over where events might lead next. At a candlelight vigil on Wednesday evening, Andy Quate, a 24-year-old from Cottage Grove, Minnesota, said that the eyes of the country on Minnesota brought him back to the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd by a police officer in 2020. More than 5 years later, he said, "It still feels raw. Now that we're the center of attention again, it's just kind of like we are the people from Minnesota going to, are the people from Minnesota going to catch a break here," he said. Throughout the day, local and state officials condemned the killing of Renee Nicole Good, a Minneapolis resident who was driving a vehicle when an Immigration and Customs Enforcement fatally shot her on a residential street. Federal officials had just begun a broad crackdown on immigration in the Twin Cities, with Department of Homeland Security officials promising that 2,000 agents would fan out in search of criminal offenders. Mayor Jacob Frey, a Democrat, called for immigration agents to get out of Minneapolis. "Now somebody is dead," he said. "That's on you. And it's also on you to leave." Mr. Walz urged Minnesotans to be calm in their response to the shooting. Federal immigration officials said that an ICE agent shot and killed Ms. Good in self-defense. They said her vehicle was driving towards the agent and she had refused to cooperate when ordered to stop. That explanation was sharply dismissed by many people in Minnesota and Minneapolis, a liberal-leaning city where suspicion of Mr. Trump and his immigration crackdown is fierce. "More than anything, I feel like we've prepared as a city for events like these," said Elliot Payne, the president of the Minneapolis City Council, as he drove to join thousands of people at vigil by nightfall. "And sadly, it's because we have been through many events like these. During the COVID pandemic, when the city was recovering from the civil unrest that followed Mr. Floyd's death, Minneapolis residents organized community aid to help neighbors who were short on food and money. They formed group chats and community patrols as crime spiked. Many of those networks came back to life when ICE agents flooded into the city in recent days, and neighbors began warning one another if agents were spotted. "This was just a bystander looking to protect their community," Mr. Payne said of Ms. Good. Even outside the Twin Cities, Minnesota residents said it was impossible to ignore the turmoil that had settled over the state. "It is exhausting," said Jesse Hennin, a professor of creative writing at Southwest Minnesota State University, who has followed the news of the ICE influx so closely she wasn't sure how she would finish preparing for the spring semester. "It's hard to focus," she said. Many people in Minnesota said they were bracing for the weeks ahead and the protests, investigations, and recriminations that were to come. Hours after Ms. Good's death, some people had already called for criminal charges to be brought against the ICE agent who shot her, while Ms. Noem said on Wednesday that she will ask the Justice Department to prosecute as domestic terrorism the use of vehicles to block immigration enforcement operations. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, just one more short article on that same topic. Victim in ICE shooting is remembered for her kindness. Renee Good, 37, a resident of Minneapolis, was mourned on Wednesday as a cherished member of the community. The woman killed by a federal agent on Wednesday in Minneapolis was remembered as a compassionate, giving person. The woman, identified by authorities as Renee Nicole Good, 37, was a cherished Minnesotan, said State Representative Lee Fink of St. Paul, Minnesota, who paid tribute to her in a statement. "Ms. Good was a loved and celebrated community member who has now been stripped away from her family," she said. Ms. Good, a U.S. citizen, lived in Minneapolis with her partner, according to an interview with her mother, Donna Ganger, in the Minnesota Star Tribune, which said that Ms. Good had a six-year-old child. Federal officials said an ICE agent shot and killed Ms. Good in self-defense, and they accused her of trying to use her vehicle to run over law enforcement officers. Local officials have strongly disputed that account. Ms. Ganger told the Star Tribune that her daughter was one of the kindest people I've ever known, adding that she was loving, forgiving, and affectionate. Ms. Ganger declined a request for additional comment, and other family members could not be immediately reached. Ms. Fink condemned the federal immigration operation that led to the fatal encounter, calling for those activities to end, as well as full transparency and accountability to ensure justice for the victim. Okay, next article. Lawmakers are split after classified briefings on Venezuela. Republicans praised what they characterized as a narrow and well-executed plan, while Democrats expressed alarm, warning that the mission was vaguely defined. As he emerged on Wednesday from a classified briefing on the military operation that led to the capture of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, Speaker Johnson sought to defend the Trump administration with an exceedingly narrow description of its objectives in the country. The mission, he said, was to bring justice to a criminal who was duly indicted under American law. "That's what this is about," the Louisiana Republican told reporters gathered outside the session. As he was speaking, Representative Veronica Escobar, Democrat of Texas, bluntly offered up a different explanation. "It's about oil," she said, as she walked behind the speaker, exiting the secure room where top Trump administration officials had just briefed House members. The exchange captured the partisan divide over the raid that toppled Mr. Maduro and a deeper sense of confusion and concern on Capitol Hill about what the Trump administration planned to do next. It came on a day when Secretary of State Marco Rubio briefed lawmakers on a three-phased plan for Venezuela that went far beyond a simple law enforcement matter and included stabilizing and rebuilding Venezuela, taking and selling its oil, and installing a new government there. That suggested a far longer term and more elaborate strategy than the Trump administration had previously laid out. Republicans emerged from the classified briefings largely praising the military action and embracing the administration's approach, while Democrats warned that the United States was drifting into an open-ended intervention without clear legal authority or a plan for how and when democratic transition could take place. Senator Mike Rounds, Republican of South Dakota, said the objective was to see a peaceful country and one that is a democracy, the way it used to be. He added that the transition should lead to a stronger economy and a close alliance with the United States. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and the minority leader said key questions had gone unanswered about next steps in the region. What the hell is going on? We need answers as to how long this is going to last. We need answers to how many troops, how much money. Are there guardrails, things we don't do? Mr. Schumer said. The Trump administration's plan, he added, was fraught with peril. Mr. Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and other top administration officials briefed lawmakers on Capitol Hill one day before the Senate was set to vote on whether to curtail Mr. Trump's power to continue using military force against Venezuela without explicit authorization by Congress. A majority of Republicans last year banded together to block similar attempts to curb the president's power to strike Venezuela, with some calling the measures premature. It was not clear whether the weekend raid, which the administration carried out without briefing key members of Congress, would change enough minds to allow the resolution to pass. Representatives Gregory Meeks, the top Democrat on the Foreign Affairs Committee, said there were still questions about Mr. Trump's legal authority to carry out a months-long escalating campaign against the government of Venezuela. I have not seen the justification, Mr. Meeks said on his way out of the briefing. We went from drugs to regime change to oil. Mr. Rubio said that the blockade of oil tankers in and out of Venezuela had given the administration leverage over the interim government. He pointed to the early morning seizure of two oil tankers on Wednesday as proof that the administration's plans to control the South American nation's vast oil resources for economic gain and influence were working. This is tremendous leverage. We are exercising it in a positive way, he said, between the two briefings on Capitol Hill. But Democrats raised alarm about Mr. Trump's assertion, repeated by Mr. Rubio on Capitol Hill, that the United States would control the revenues from the sale of seized Venezuelan oil. The president cannot grab Venezuela's oil for his own slush fund, Senator Chris Von Hollen, Democrat of Maryland and a member of the Appropriations Committee, said on Wednesday. Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, applauded the operation that led to Mr. Maduro's capture and expressed confidence that the United States would be able to exert substantial control over Delcy Rodriguez, who has been tapped as interim president. Secretary Rubio is obviously working on that, Mr. Cornyn said. The U.S. has a lot of levers to persuade her compliance. Democrats complained that they were given little detail about how soon the transition to an independent democratic government would take place. Representative Jared Moskowitz, Democrat of Florida, said that there has to be a timeline for elections, but that everyone understands that it's not going to happen immediately, he said. that administration officials had not provided specifics about when Venezuelans would go to the polls to elect a new leader. When pressed on how long U.S. involvement would last, Mr. Rubio cautioned that it had been only 4 days since this happened, adding that Venezuela's long-term transformation would immediately rest with its people. He said that the first priority would be the stabilization of the country. "We wouldn't want it descending into chaos," Mr. Rubio said, adding that he had been working with the interim president, Ms. Rodriguez, with whom he had spoken several times since the weekend raid. Mr. Rubio outlined the three-phase plan, which would seek to first stabilize the country, then ensure that American, Western, and other companies have access to Venezuela's oil market, and a final political transition, which he did not detail. Okay, moving on, next article. Push to audit private equity and venture capital falters under Trump. Specialists have left the IRS and audits have been abandoned since the president returned to office. 2 years ago, Internal Revenue Service officials announced an ambitious plan to fix a gaping hole in federal tax law enforcement. For decades, the agency had not conducted significant audits of private equity, venture capital, or real estate investment firms, industries equal in size to the economies of Germany, Japan, and India combined. These companies were typically structured as partnerships, governed by a subspecialty of the tax law that few in the IRS knew how to examine. The agency quickly hired and trained hundreds of examiners to dig into such vehicles. They helped uncover a whole new family of aggressive tax shelters used by companies, including Occidental Petroleum, that the Treasury estimated would cost the public at least $100 billion over a decade. Now the effort is falling apart. Since President Trump returned to office, nearly all the senior leaders of the operation have left the IRS, taking the newly acquired partnership tax expertise with them. Audits have been abandoned. They have decreased in number, and the initiative is floundering. Progress on complex audits has slowed to a trickle. Tax lawyers who specialize in this case, in these types of cases, had said. The new initiative's emphasis on large partnership exams has not gone completely to zero, but it has certainly dropped 80 or 90%, said Gary Huffman, a tax lawyer at Vinson and Elkins, who represents partnerships that are being audited. A lawyer who handled roughly 15 such audits in 2024 reported only three in 2025. Another who advised clients on four such audits in 2024 saw zero new audits in 2025. The turn away from audits of big partnerships is part of the IRS's broader chaos, which has been accompanied by a slew of tax giveaways to industry in Mr. Trump's new term. Big companies are benefiting from the gutting of regulations, and the agency is pulling back from a crackdown on various shelters. The agency is likely to be even more compromised because it has fewer officials to handle the current filing season after significant changes to tax law. From the early days of the second Trump administration, right-wing anti-tax groups have been attacking IRS officials overseeing partnership audits. Holly Paz, a top IRS official, is suing the agency, alleging that administration officials illegally leaked her employment information to Fox News. Now, nearly all the IRS officials overseeing the effort, about 15, including recent hires from the private sector, have quit, according to people familiar with the activity. The IRS official in charge of the audits abruptly left the agency earlier last year. The cost-cutting department of government efficiency project encouraged the exodus. The IRS laid off thousands of probationary employees, disproportionately hitting the partnership audit team because so many technical experts on the team were recent hires. We were having good success bringing into the IRS seasoned tax and legal expertise to help with complex audits, including for large partnerships, said Danny Werfel, who served as IRS commissioner for the final 2 years of the Biden administration. Because these folks were relatively new hires, they are probationary employees. When all probationary employees were let go, lots of talent walked out the door. An IRS spokesman declined to comment. Unlike corporations, partnerships do not pay income taxes themselves. Instead, the tax obligation flows through to the partners. Each partner's share of the tax obligation is based on his or her share of the partnership's profits or losses. Those allocations are made according to complex rules that dizzy even veteran tax lawyers and allow tax planners to engineer elaborate tax avoidance structures. The tax rules for partnerships were created in the 1950s, when such vehicles were used to operate, say, family grocery stores, not multi-billion-dollar investment vehicles with partners across the globe. Business activities has moved increasingly from traditional corporations to partnerships, or pass-throughs. Profits reported by partnerships exploded to $2.6 trillion by 2022, from $267 billion in 2000. The most recent IRS data shows. Profits reported by traditional corporations grew at about half that pace, but the IRS failed to keep up. The New York Times revealed in a 2021 investigation that a lack of expertise meant the IRS virtually never audited private equity firms like Blackstone and Apollo. Michael Desmond, the IRS chief counsel during the first Trump administration, acknowledged that such audits were almost non-existent because the agency just doesn't have the resources or the expertise. By late 2023, the agency had expanded the program and set plans to audit 75 of the largest partnerships in the United States, including hedge funds and real estate investment partnerships. Their assets, on average, exceeded more than $10 billion. The IRS said the efforts were meant to shift attention to wealthy from working class taxpayers and to identify sophisticated schemes to avoid taxes. Since Mr. Trump's return to office, business and right-wing groups have lobbied the IRS and Treasury to eliminate the partnership audit group. The National Association of Manufacturers accused the team of contributing to the overreaching and unduly burdensome administrative state that the current administration is seeking to curtail. And a new anti-tax group, the Alliance for IRS Accountability, urged the administration and Congress to eliminate the unit, calling it a prime example of government weaponization, targeting political opponents. The group offered no evidence for this claim. With no one left to look for the dodges, tax experts warn that abusive shelters are likely to proliferate. A recent study by a team of business and law school professors at schools including Stanford and University of Georgia, New York University, and the University of Chicago found that audits of complex partnerships had a high return on investment, generating $20 in collected taxes for each $1 spent by the IRS. That return is over 8 times what the IRS generates from auditing corporations, the research found. Okay, on to the next article. Trump withdraws the U.S. from more international organizations. The executive order the president signed Wednesday follows a broader vision of American foreign policy that shuns coalition building and the consensus of nations. President Trump withdrew the United States on Wednesday from dozens of international organizations intended to foster multinational cooperation, cutting ties with a wide range of prominent forums addressing international security, law, trade, economics, and human rights. Secretary of State Marco Rubio listed several reasons for the simultaneous withdrawal from so many international organizations, many of which are part of the United Nations, pointing to waste, mismanagement, and redundancy. Mr. Rubio more broadly suggested in his statement that the international influence gained from sending U.S. representatives to these organizations was ultimately not worth the effort. It is no longer acceptable to be sending these institutions the blood, sweat, and treasure of the American people, with little to nothing to show for it, Mr. Rubio said, asserting that many of the organizations were dominated by progressive ideology, including gender equality and climate change. In trumpeting the withdrawal, Mr. Rubio suggested that it was in line with the Trump administration's decision to shutter the U.S. Agency for International Development. The United Nations did not immediately comment on the United States' severing relationships with several of its organizations. An executive order signed by Mr. Trump on Wednesday follows a broader vision of American foreign policy that shuns the consensus of nations and building coalitions, focusing almost solely on projecting American power and dominance. But Mr. Trump's unilateral withdrawal from international bodies stands out, even when compared with the actions of other regional and world powers that are skeptical of international agreements on democracy, climate change, or human rights. Biden administration officials have argued that withdrawal from these bodies would create a vacuum for U.S. rivals to exploit. For example, China and Russia are both members of the Global Counterterrorism Forum, the International Energy Forum, and the International Renewable Energy Agency, as well as the UN's International Law Commission, Peacebuilding Commission, Alliance of Civilizations, and the Register of Conventional Arms. The United States withdrew from all of them on Wednesday. Many of the organizations listed in Mr. Trump's executive order also do not appear to require direct membership from nations. But the move seemed to signal more broadly that the Trump administration was likely to refuse to cooperate with them. Mr. Trump has already pulled the United States out of many significant UN organizations, including UNESCO, the UN's cultural agency, the World Health Organization, and the UN Human Rights Council. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, moving on, next article. This is from the opinion section of the New York Times, an article by Emily Oster. Kennedy is telling Americans how to eat, and it's not crazy advice. On Wednesday, the Trump administration came out with new dietary guidelines for the United States. The goal is to give Americans guidance about what makes a healthy diet. As promised, the new guidelines are much shorter than in the past, 10 pages versus 100 or more, and written to be widely accessible. Many people will read these and possibly take the advice. Under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s leadership, the Trump administration has made many public health changes that have medical experts concerned. Just this week, changes to the childhood vaccine schedule. However, the new nutrition advice is, dare I say it, overall very sensible. It emphasizes fruits and vegetables, prioritizes whole food, and is clear that people's food choices should depend on individual characteristics like age and activity. This doesn't, however, mean that everything in here makes sense for everyone. In brief, here's the good, the fine, and the weird parts of the new nutrition guidelines. The good. Emphasis on whole foods. The guidelines advise people to eat whole foods, or real food. This is broadly very good. Virtually all nutrition experts agree that eating foods in which the ingredients are limited, recognizable, and not highly processed is a good thing. Heavily processed foods can increase caloric consumption and thus contribute to obesity. Early allergen exposure. The new guidelines continue to emphasize the introduction of allergens, including food containing peanuts, but also wheat, eggs, and shellfish. At around 6 months, because of very clear data, that it lowers the risk of developing food allergies later. This may seem like a small point, but an estimated 8% of children have food allergies, and it's an easy change parents can make with potentially large impacts on public health. This was in the older guidelines, but highlighted in this much shorter document is worth a lot. The totally fine area. Full fat dairy. The new guidelines push for consuming full fat dairy. For years, there has been an emphasis on reducing fat dairy, especially for children, because it has fewer calories and less saturated fat. But in the data, there is no consistent association between reduced fat dairy and weight. And if anything, full fat dairy is associated with lower obesity rates. However, if you prefer reduced or non-fat dairy, there isn't any evidence-based reason not to consume it. All dairy is fine. Now, the complex area. Protein. Perhaps the biggest change in the new guidelines is recommended protein intake. The previous recommended dietary allowance for protein was 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight per day. The average American adult weighs about 180 pounds. So this amounts to about 70 grams of protein per day. Most Americans already eat this much protein, or a bit more. The new guidelines suggest 50 to 100% more protein, 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram. For someone who weighs 180 pounds, this might mean adding at the amount of protein that you might find in 7 ounces of chicken breast or 10 eggs. Most people probably won't get all that much benefit from eating 10 eggs every day, or gulping down protein water or any other protein-heavy snacks that have become popular on grocery store shelves. That's because the benefits to more protein only really show up when combined with resistance training. When you lift weights, you create microscopic tears in your muscles that the body uses protein to repair. But when you consume more protein than you need to rebuild muscle, the excess protein is treated like other calorie sources. Most Americans do not get very much exercise, and fewer than 25% get the recommended resistance training. This means that for most people, if they eat more protein, they will not get stronger or healthier. Moreover, this advice may be counterproductive. Many Americans will hear this as add protein rather than replace other calories with protein. This may lead people to simply eat more calorie-dense foods like red meat, when most people do not need it. No added sugar for kids. Previous guidelines suggest that no added sugar in food for children under 2. The new guidelines extend this up to age 10. On the one hand, some of our most compelling data on diet suggests that excess sugar in early childhood leads to more health problems, even more later in life. This may be because early sugar exposure can affect children's long-term taste preferences. American children currently consume a lot of added sugar. On the other hand, avoiding added sugar under the age of 10 is unrealistic for nearly everyone. The nutrition guidelines, which suggested no cookies or birthday cake until a child is 11, are likely to scare parents without changing behavior. It's also not well supported by the science. While there is data that consuming a lot of sugar leads to more metabolic issues later in life, this isn't compared to no sugar. The healthier children in the United States had some sugar, just not as much, and completely limiting food groups for children can make forbidden food more appealing. There is balance here. More children in America would benefit from eating less sugar, but that doesn't mean parents should be afraid of every cookie. Moderation is key. Now to the weird area. Beef tallow. Why do we keep mentioning this? Who is using this for cooking? Where would I even buy it? Mr. Kennedy seems to love beef tallow as a healthy fat, but it's also very high in saturated fat, and these guidelines set limits on that. The upside-down pyramid. I get it as a talking point, but the upside-down pyramid used to illustrate the guidelines isn't helping anyone, and the blueberries are disturbingly large. If there is one thing to strongly object to about these guidelines, it's that they are likely to be hard for many people to follow. Eating more vegetables, lean protein, and whole foods is a laudable goal and also difficult to achieve, especially with limited financial resources. Limited grocery options and the fact that high sugar, high fat foods are addictive and habit forming. These guidelines are a very good start for telling people where to go. Now, the job should be helping them get there. Okay, we can fit in one more article today. Josh Shapiro begins a re-election bid that carries implications for 2028. The Pennsylvania governor starts out as a clear favorite, but Republicans are trying to make him sweat. Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, widely seen as one of the Democrat Party's strongest rising politicians and a possible presidential contender, kicked off a high-stakes governor's race on Thursday by announcing his re-election bid. "We've gotten stuff done all across our Commonwealth," Mr. Shapiro declared 30 seconds into his announcement video, using a more colorful word than stuff and pledging to do more. The long-expected move marks the beginning of a significant new chapter for Mr. Shapiro, who is also releasing a memoir later this month. The governor, already a national Democratic figure after becoming a finalist in his party's 2024 vice presidential search, is often floated as a potential 2028 presidential candidate. He has gained a reputation for notching notable victories in perhaps the nation's most crucial political battleground. Republicans hope to take some of that sheen off Mr. Shapiro this year, even if they face an uphill battle to defeat him and his November performance, to outcome itself, and if he wins, by what margin. Will go a long way towards shaping national perceptions of his visible viability as a candidate for higher office. In the video, of course, Mr. Shapiro kept his focus on Pennsylvania. He reintroduced himself to viewers as a pragmatic politician focused on economic growth and affordability, public safety, and education, including expanding state opportunities for people without college degrees. As in other places around the country, working-class voters in Pennsylvania have drifted away from the Democratic Party, helping President Trump win the state twice. Nearly 60% of our new hires don't have college degrees, opening up the doors of opportunity to more Pennsylvanians who'd been shut out, Mr. Shapiro had said. While he avoided making overtly partisan comments, the video alluded to his efforts to protect abortion rights in the state and to reject Mr. Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. Mr. Shapiro, who plans to hold campaign events in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia on Thursday, starts the race with considerable advantages. This week, his campaign announced that he ended 2025 with more than $30 million in cash on hand, and what his team said was a state record. He has also repeatedly earned high approval ratings while in office. The question for Pennsylvania Republicans is whether they have found a candidate that can put up a serious challenge to Mr. Shapiro, scrutinizing his record and raising the kind of money needed to compete vigorously statewide. They certainly did not have that in 2022 when Mr. Shapiro won his first campaign for governor by nearly 15 percentage points over Doug Mastrioni, a far-right opponent who spent the home stretch of the campaign in fasting and prayer. Mr. Mastriano, now sporting a scruffy beard, teased at another run for governor on Wednesday during a Facebook live stream that included a nearly half-hour highlight video of his failed 2022 campaign. Eventually, he declared, alongside his wife, that God has not called us to run for governor this year. This year, the Republican Party of Pennsylvania is supporting Stacey Garrity, the state treasurer for the governor. Ms. Garrity is already bashing Mr. Shapiro as being overly focused on his national ambitions, while Pennsylvania Democrats are casting Ms. Garrity as too extreme for the state. Early polling shows that she faces a tall task in introducing herself. A poll last fall showed that 13% of Pennsylvanians surveyed had a favorable opinion of Ms. Garrity, 12% had an unfavorable view, and 73% said they hadn't heard enough about her. In contrast, Mr. Shapiro's favorability rating was at 58%. Mr. Shapiro has been working to build out his national profile, going beyond what Americans now know about him from then Vice President Kamala Harris' search for a running mate in 2024. Mr. Shapiro, who has an extensive donor network, will begin his book tour this month. Closer to home, he has already endorsed candidates in some Pennsylvania House races. After enduring an arson attack on the governor's residence over Passover last year, he has also been outspoken about the importance of confronting political violence. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 8th issue of the New York Times. Your reader today has been Mark Reier. Thank you so much for listening.